to the final episode of the Stories from the Field podcast. I'm Aura Suckley, Associate Professor of Political Science at Clark University, and this is my co-host, Peter Kraus, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College and Research Affiliate in the MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Aura, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm a little sad that this is the end of the line.
I know, right?
But at the same time, happy because I'm happy with how the podcast turned out, and I'll miss our weekly chats together about fieldwork. At least they won't be recorded anymore. But in any case, I'm doing all right.
All of the above for me as well. So in this last episode, we wanted to spend some time reflecting on what we've learned from both the book and the podcast, and maybe think through some of the larger takeaways about fieldwork and also about political science as a discipline overall. I don't know about you, for myself, one thing that I have learned is that organizing anything involving 44 academics is extremely complicated logistically.
Yeah, a herd of cats, right?
Right. One. I think that was maybe more true of the book than it was of the podcast. I think the podcast was maybe a little bit less complicated to put together than the book, maybe because we'd had more practice by then. Although I think we both learned a lot about podcasting, and we're also really, really grateful to our amazing production team, mostly your research assistants, Peter.
100%. But, and I'll also add, and I think we maybe mentioned this in an earlier episode, even though, having 44 different scholars in a book seems like an incredibly daunting task, I will say that it actually wasn't that challenging. People were very on time with getting their writing in and being responsive. So I don't know if it's just people were motivated about this project or otherwise, but I was expecting it to be much more challenging, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true. I think people really came through in terms of getting us material on time and also just being really thoughtful about what they included in their contributions to the book and also the conversations that we had here on the podcast.
Agreed. Totally.
So let's think back a little bit. Eons ago, when the world was young, dinosaurs roamed the earth, and we first came up with the idea for this book and then what would eventually become the podcast, Stories from the Field. Where did that title come from?
Yeah, so, we talk about it a little bit in the intro for the book, but, I think for both of us, we like this concept of stories because it really puts the reader there and it really personalizes a lot of these experiences and lessons. We are really drilled in as scholars into us for all of our publications that you want the bottom line up front. Right? This is not a novel. You want to have your key question, your key argument, right, your conclusions right at the beginning, in the abstract, in the intro. And I think there's a lot of value to that when we're talking about these scholarly publications. But, when we think about other ways of learning, that's not necessarily always the best ways to learn, especially because when you're learning a new skill or a new experience, there's a great deal of uncertainty. And so we really thought that learning by storytelling, by reading stories, allows the listener or the reader to kind of travel along with the researcher. And I think really understand exactly what it's like to do something with some degree of uncertainty, to go through the process of discovery, to have these kind of rich personal stories really guide the reader to learn this new skill, or maybe to hone these skills of interviewing or archival research that they've already tried before, but maybe want to improve on.
I always tell my students that a research paper or an academic article, it's not a mystery novel, right? You don't want to get to the last page and find out that the IMF did it in the conservatory with the structural adjustment. You're meant to know what the argument is up front. But the reality is, for many of us, when we begin our research, we really don't know what the answer is. That's one of the great joys of academic research, picking a question that you are genuinely curious about and trying to figure out the answer. And I think you're absolutely right that the storytelling format, I think, mimics the actual process of research in ways that I hope have been very helpful for readers.
One of the other things we wanted to do with the storytelling and to try to make it, casual is the wrong word, because as we'll talk about in just a moment, we think these are very serious and important topics and we want people to be able to learn about them from some of the people we think have done the best work on it. But I think it is important to kind of knock people out of their comfort zone a little bit, because so much of this stuff never ends up on the pages of journals or books, right? But we know how important people's relationships are to their fieldwork sites, to the people that they work with. And just because of the norms of our field, a lot of that stuff doesn't get included. People don't talk about the ethical choices they're making about how they design their work a lot, although there's an increasing amount of that, thankfully. People aren't talking about, again, these personal relationships, about, their emotional experience that they had in the field. And so one of the reasons we wanted to slightly change up the format, both for the book and for the podcast, was to shake some of that stuff out. Whereas if we kept the, regular approach to doing research, it would have been harder for people to kind of introduce that or have us pull that out. So I think that was a lot of our our motivation as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to add to this, I would also say, you know, there is this ongoing and much needed reassessment of the problematic approaches to what we would say are extractive or shallow or exploitative field research. And we also really wanted our project to help address some of those issues by pushing us to think about how we individually and collectively have done fieldwork and what are some models of how to do so in a more collaborative, positive way that represent good scholarly research. And really, we think that learning from each other is one of the best ways to go. So, you know, what are your thoughts on this, Aura, both in terms of the book or the podcast or how we can do this stuff better?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we knew immediately at the very beginning of this process that what we didn't want was to collect a set of stories that trivialized or took lightly the very serious challenges of field research or that completely ignored ethical questions, right? Like what we wanted was something thoughtful and reflective to showcase how this kind of storytelling can be a really helpful form of collective and community learning, right? Rather than macho one-upmanship where everybody's sort of sitting around and saying, well, did I tell you about the time I stole a tank, right? Not that I have ever heard anyone tell me a story about stealing a tank, thankfully, right? But speaking of ethical violations, right? And I was really moved, actually, by how thoughtful and really vulnerable many of the contributors to our volume were in terms of thinking and sharing some really serious and sometimes very personal aspects of field research. So in that sense, I was really pleased and very grateful with how the contributors to our volume and also the people we've had on this podcast came through and were willing to do this, I think sort of as a service to the discipline. I'm really grateful to them for being willing to share that with us. Now, not all field work, right, is harmful or dangerous. In fact, a lot of field work is just sitting in a hotel room waiting for somebody to call you back. Or at least that's been my experience of a lot of field work, right? And we don't want to overstate the potential risks associated with this. But what we're interested in doing here is sharing what's worked and encouraging other scholars who've done fantastic work to share what's worked for them. And I think that thinking through what's worked and being honest about what hasn't worked, being upfront about what's been challenging, about things that in retrospect, maybe we wish we'd done differently, I think all of that can help us make the enterprise of academic research better for all of us as researchers, and more importantly, for those who participate in our research. You know, my dissertation advisor, Steve Sedeman, who's also a contributor to this book, always says there's a reason they call it a social science. There is something that is collaborative about this enterprise. And so trying to mine our collective knowledge, I think, is part of what we're trying to do here.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, I think that there certainly are elements of both this podcast and the book where we're talking again about things that were problematic that have been done or ways to improve. But I hope that also the book and the podcast have brought out the fact that we consider field research to be a wonderful enterprise, to be something that helps us learn about the world, that can create positive relationships across nations, across boundaries, in your own community. I think that that's really something we care about. We want to further the idea of conscientious field research, but also positive field research. And, you know, throughout this episode, we're going to bring in some of the readings from the book and some of our favorite clips from some of the previous podcasts to highlight some of these points and, you know, further the discussion. So one of the first ones I wanted to read was from Melissa Noble's chapter, Race and the Study of a Racial Democracy. And so she talks about her time doing field research in Brazil in particular, and some of the challenges she faced there being a Black American and how she was perceived in Brazil and the role of skin color and race and these types of issues regarding how people there perceived her. But what's interesting is when she concludes her chapter, she writes the following. Finally, I conclude these comments with a robust declaration in support of fieldwork. If you are reading this book, you probably do not need to be convinced, but I still want to offer words of affirmation and encouragement. The ease with which written materials, journal articles, books, magazine and newspaper articles, surveys, and other types of data can be obtained without ever leaving your office makes this affirmative statement necessary. There is no easy substitute for the human experience of visiting a place and interacting with the people. As a researcher, you are charged and informed by these experiences in ways that extend far beyond what you learn from text or what you may write. When I finished my fieldwork in Brazil, I knew I was not leaving a racial democracy. In addition, I left with more knowledge about, deeper interest in, and greater appreciation for a range of issues in Brazilian politics and society, including and extending beyond race. As my example and those of my colleagues in this book amply show, fieldwork not only generates original scholarship, but also broadens and deepens your intellectual and personal perspective. So I thought that that was, you know, a great quote with a lot to it. But I'd love to hear your reactions and thoughts about that, Aura.
You know, I think in her entire chapter, but particularly in that passage, Melissa Nobles really captures the core advantages of field research. And this comes up in a number of places in the book, which is that you don't always know going into it what you're going to learn. And that's kind of the point, right? It's the unknown unknowns, I guess. It's the stuff that you learn while you're there that you weren't necessarily anticipating you would find that broadens your perspective in unanticipated and I think really important ways. And it's by immersing yourself in a new environment or maybe a familiar environment with a particular set of questions that you're able to sort of figure out what the story is that you're trying to tell, not in the sense of storytelling like we're doing in this book, but in the sense of, you know, telling a story about the way the world is or the way the political world is. When I was finishing my dissertation research, when I was a graduate student, before I got on the plane to fly back to Canada, I was staying in Amman towards the end of my field research, and I was trying to organize everything that I learned. I had all of these notes. I had all of these like interactions that I'd had with people, all of these interviews that I'd done and things that I'd seen and events that I'd gone to. And there were all these different themes that I was trying really hard to organize in my head. And I just was having a really hard time finding the through line. And so I went to a grocery store in my neighborhood and I bought a roll of butcher paper, which was, you know, like, I don't know, 15 meters long or something, maybe not quite that long. And I went home and I rolled it out on the floor of my bedroom in the flat I was staying in and I'm on. And I just started writing and I essentially drew my field research. I had like little boxes with all of the conversations I'd had and the stuff that I learned and these different themes. And I, you know, color coded the whole thing. I still have it somewhere, and it absolutely makes no sense to anyone who's not me. But the sense that when you're in the field, you're just kind of absorbing all of this new experience and all of this new information that relates to your core question, and you're building relationships with people, not in the abstract, but like actual people who are part of what you're trying to understand. I think there's something really invaluable about that, which I think is a big part of why field research remains so important.
Yeah, I think that's a fabulous story and example. And number one, I hope that you've kept that butcher paper and you have it somewhere.
I do. I think it's in my like research box somewhere.
I think that's great. And I can see this vision in like 30 years where your grad students are like, oh, Professor Seckley is pulling out the butcher paper again. Here comes that story. But nonetheless, I think that's a great example of, as you say, I think a very common experience that many people have with field work when after you've worked in the archives, you know, done your interviews, et cetera, coming back and you have all this information, trying to sort it out and, you know, hopefully having that moment of zen or understanding that helps you start to put things back together, even though, of course, nuance and complexity remains.
There are a lot of other important reasons to do field research as well, which Amani Jamal unpacks for us a little bit in her chapter. And I want to read through some of the points that she makes in outlining why she thinks that field research, not just as a way of collecting data, but almost for its own sake, remains really important. She writes, "The continuing evolution of epistemological paradigms depends on accurate context-based research, fieldwork, and not merely data acquisition, as David Layton reminds us in his essay." And then she quotes David Layton saying, "And when you demonstrate to local informants that you are sensitive to their incentives, you are likely to get more reliable interpretations from them." She goes on, "Academic networks are built through fieldwork. Students often take advantage of the networks their advisors have built, and in return, they should rebuild new networks for their own students." What do you make of this?
I think there's a lot of really important points here. On the first one, you know, this idea that data acquisition, this idea of, you know, going in and grabbing a bunch of information. First off, that's only possible because people know or think they know, you know, what are the questions to ask or what are the things that are available? And that relies oftentimes on people who have done field research before, people who have published about a given region or an area. And so it's a very short-term strategy that's not going to last if you just rely on previous fieldwork or things like this, and then, you know, people can grab data or do whatever else based on those understandings. So I agree, especially given that regions and areas and people change, that you constantly need to be returning to the field, quote unquote, or returning to the region of study in your field site to understand those changes and those dynamics. Otherwise, the kind of, you know, data acquisition strategies are, number one, not going to be that effective, let alone the problematic aspects of their kind of extractive approach. So I think that that's really well said. And on the second point, I also think that's important because, you know, when we talk about field research, one of the challenges for sure, and talking about as a collective enterprise, is okay, maybe individually it's okay for you to go and, you know, interview people or whatever else. But if you just increase the number and say, okay, is it okay for 10,000 researchers to do exactly what you're doing? Does that become just a huge burden on a community? That's really important. And so I think networks are important in that regard because it makes it so you don't have to reinvent the wheel each time, but also people can have kind of trusted individuals that they can use to introduce to one another, to understand the legitimacy of who's doing, you know, various types of work, and also hopefully to kind of channel and funnel the types of people who are doing research in a way that's not overly a burden on the whole community that are being asked from 50 different angles about maybe similar projects. So I think there really is value in that. And I think Amani brings up really great points there. What are your thoughts?
I agree. And again, I sort of come back to this idea that, like, look, there's a reason that we call it a social science, that there's, which this is not actually the reason it's called a social science, but it's, there is something collective about this enterprise, and we build on the work that others have done before us. But at the same time, we also don't want to overburden individual communities, right? So rather than perpetually reproducing what other people have already done, right? You kind of want to look at the kind of work that others have done and then think, okay, where are the holes? Where are the gaps? How can I build on this? Hopefully in ways that are also beneficial to the communities who are being researched.
Agreed. And, you know, the next two points that Amani has there, first one kind of, you know, supports what we're saying, the academic enterprise and building social science capacity, both here in the United States and abroad, depends on active engagement and intellectual reciprocity, often facilitated by scholars while they are conducting fieldwork. So totally agree with that point. The final point, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. She writes, treating fieldwork as research, quote, laboratories, risks reproducing and exacerbating global academic and intellectual disparities and inequalities. So you were starting to say something about this, but, you know, what are your thoughts on this point that Amani makes?
Well, so, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to dismiss field experiments or experimental research as like an entire enterprise, right? We've had people on the podcast who've done fantastic, really thoughtful, and I think very careful, ethical, and respectful research that falls under this heading. But I also think that what Amani is pointing to here is this almost like psychological risk of separating, quote unquote, the field as the place where we go to experiments from the real world, as it were, right? That like when you think of the field as the separate other place where you go to do research, I think there's almost a risk that you stop thinking about it as a place where people actually live, right? And that I think that's something that we need to be extremely careful about. You know, in that sense, I think that's partly the source of the academic and intellectual disparities and inequalities that Amani is pointing to here. Because, of course, there are also academics who, and you know, there are excellent universities full of academics who are doing their own field research in the places that are sometimes thought of as the fields. Those are our colleagues. Sometimes, you know, people who live in one person's field are off doing their own research in some, you know, in their own field. And there are lots of people, of course, who do field research in their own neighborhoods, including here in the United States. And so I think being very cognizant of the fact that, like, it's not like there's like two categories of place. There's the real world, and then there's like the laboratory where we do research. That's not what political science is as a discipline. And being careful that we don't fall into that trap, I think is really, really important.
Yep. I think that that's important to note. And I would agree that, you know, just to reiterate, we are methodological pluralists, as I think becomes clear in the book and the authors that we have, as well as maybe a little bit in our own research. I'm generally trained as a qualitative quote unquote researcher who works in the archives and does interviews. But, you know, I've also done some experiments now and do a little, you know, statistical analysis here and there. And I think that it's important to note that we support all of those methods. But you're right, when we talk about field research and, you know, extractive work, that first of all, that can be done either way. You can do extractive research doing interviews or stealing archival documents, as unfortunately we've seen in the news happen in some cases. And you can do fantastically ethical and collaborative work running an experiment with, you know, partners from a given area that you're studying along with you in terms of who gets the credit, in terms of how it's carried out to benefit the local community. So there's no, you know, this method has more advantages than that one in this regard. They can both be done well and both be done poorly. But I think Amani's bringing up great points there about not exacerbating any of those disparities and inequalities and being cognizant of that.
You know, I would add one more thing, which is that her chapter starts with this very alarming story about her entire research team getting arrested, and that she's able to manage this situation. So she's in Jordan, you know, some of her research team get arrested, and she's able to manage the situation because she spent a lot of time in Jordan and she knows who to call and she has connections there. And she's, you know, she hasn't sort of like parachuted in for smash and grab research. This is a place where she has a network and she knows who to get in touch with to remedy the situation, which that's a pretty good argument for the idea of, you know, like local networks and also academic networks as being pretty important to this entire enterprise. Now, I want to turn to one of the conversations that we had during the podcast. And in fact, we're going to play a clip from one of our earlier episodes in which Nadia Hajj, professor at Wellesley, reflects on how fieldwork can help us engage more thoughtfully with the communities where we're doing research and can actually help to dispel some pretty harmful and unfortunate preconceptions about different parts of the world. So let me go ahead and play the clip.
Yeah, I mean, I think this idea of people saying, oh, it must be so hard for you to go do work in the Middle East because you're a woman is the most orientalist claim. And it's also, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it soon, the idea that, you know, the Middle East is some conflict-ridden zone because of their old identities. And I want to be like, hey, America, pot meet kettle. Like, let's talk about what identity politics and conflict is like. And, you know, it's like it makes me like, it's almost so offensive. It makes me laugh, you know, because it's so beyond the pale that someone would say that in 2020. Because when you've actually been with men and women in these spaces and those that are not gender conforming in these spaces, you realize that it's a complex place. It's not existing in this binary that many of us want to have, that you know, popularly many people have about the region or the communities there. And it's, I think, you know, one of the best reasons to encourage folks to do research is to go see that, you know, to have the opportunity to see the fullness of the human experience, the ugly suffering, and then the joyful absurdity and hilarity of it, all at the same time. Because even amidst all this suffering happening in Lebanon right now, like, people are finding ways to have humor and to, you know, find joy in those moments despite that. And I think that, you know, that's sometimes what gets lost in these, like, oh, it must be hard for a woman, or there, it's just so terrible and conflict ridden. You miss the fullness of humanity when we say that.
Now, I should say that we recorded that episode, I think, just a day or two after the explosion in the port of Beirut this summer, which was, you know, of course, an enormous tragedy for the city of Beirut and for Lebanon. Peter, what do you make of what Nadia is conveying to us there?
Well, I think she's bringing up enormously important points that, you know, I think are not brand new to us as people who work in the Middle East politics field, and unfortunately have probably had these similar experiences where people ask us what it's like to study the Middle East, where all we read about in the news is conflict and conflict and conflict and all of these, you know, problematic gender norms, etc. And I think that when I hear Nadia talk about that, I think that it gets into some really important issues about, on the one hand, like, maybe if you're a researcher who does study like why conflict happens or how peace building occurs, that, you know, unfortunately, there are a number of ongoing civil wars in the Middle East now. And so that might be one of the reasons that you're focusing on studying Syria or Yemen, or, you know, look at refugee populations.
For sure.
But I also think it's important because one of the key aspects of field research, right, is that you're producing content that's not just going to be read by other academics, but that's going to be read by the general public. And so I think it's important to have an understanding of how the general public views the topics or the regions that one is analyzing in your field research. So in part, you can kind of head off some of these challenges, or also to some extent change people's perspectives. I think that's one of the most important things. You know, if you think about field research, even if it's just doing field research in your own community, people, I think, have misperceptions about what life is like there. And I think it's part of our duty as academics, if we get this, you know, wonderful privilege of being able to spend time going and talking to people, really studying deeply some issue or some aspect of society, to then be able to kind of quote unquote report back and explain to communities, maybe in our own hometown or country country or whatever else, here's kind of what actually is going on. Here's the way that people really are there that maybe you're not going to get in more kind of shallow media accounts. And so I think Nadia's hitting on some really important things there that sure the academy itself has to grapple with, because there are huge challenges there, as we talk about and people mention throughout the book, in terms of people's personal biases, how the field structures, you know, incentives for people to maybe do problematic research and or, you know, bring some of their own biases to bear in terms of how certain areas or people are talked about. I think those are huge problems we have in our own discipline. But I do think that there's another duty that we have and a responsibility and an ability we have to change people's perceptions for the good and for the better about these areas that we study. And I think to me, Nadia is talking about that and the challenges that we face, but also maybe some ways that we can address it.
Absolutely. And I think building off of that, what you've just said, I think is a pretty good argument for another part of the academic job, which is public engagement. You know, giving talks to community groups or to schools or doing some outreach to share our research beyond our academic communities, but to try and, you know, share some of the personal conversations that we've had or the personal relationships that we've built, to try and share the day-to-day reality that we have witnessed in the parts of the world that we study with people who maybe have not had the opportunity to spend time there and to get to know it in a real and human sense.
I think that's really important. I'll just quick aside, like, so I teach a class on the Arab-Israeli conflict at BC. And even though that's the purpose of the class, and that's why people are studying it, you know, one of the things I've added is I add a week or two on kind of arts and culture, in part because even though the purpose of it is to study conflict and study, you know, diplomacy and some of the violence that's happened on various sides, etc., I just don't want people to come away from it thinking, okay, this is all that these people's lives are. It's like, there's no music, there's no employment issues, yeah, there's no relationship problems, etc. And I think if you really ask them, people obviously understand that that's the case. But I think that the content that we present also matters. And so trying to have a more holistic presentation of the things that we're studying, I think is important. And I think that also comes through in our discussions about field research, right? Because when we're doing field research, we might be analyzing a particular topic, but yeah, of course we get massive amounts of information and experiences that aren't necessarily related exactly to that topic. But I think that those are valuable too.
On my survey course on the politics of the Middle East, I also have like optional readings, quote unquote, on the syllabus, which are like movies and albums and, you know, all kinds of other novels, all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah. So a question I wanted to ask you, Aura, thinking back on the podcast, is obviously we've conducted a significant amount of field research and, you know, the podcast itself is obviously a series of interviews and discussions. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on to what extent having done field research actually prepared you or prepared us for hosting a podcast.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I think my answer is surprisingly well. Pretty frequently, hosting the podcast felt a lot like doing fieldwork, or at least there were significant similarities to conducting a semi-structured interview. I think we both tried to make ourselves as invisible, or if not invisible, as neutral as possible in the conversations, because we were trying to center our guests and their experiences and to, you know, prioritize their voices in the conversation, which is certainly something that I try to do when I'm conducting interviews. We certainly had a set of questions ready to go for each interview, but we sometimes, you know, wouldn't get through all the questions, or the conversation would kind of meander in a totally different direction because of what our guests really wanted to share with us. So we tried to sort of let the conversations grow as naturally as possible. And those were often the times when I felt like we had the richest and most interesting exchanges, which is often what I have found while doing interviews as well.
Yeah, totally agreed.
I think we had some ideas about the kinds of conversations that we wanted to have. And so we ended up having some of those conversations, but not always. Sometimes we ended up somewhere really unexpected, often with, you know, really terrific results. So I like to think that our experience conducting interviews in other settings gave us at least a little bit of practice going into this, so that we at least had some sense of how to conduct this kind of conversation. But I also do think there was a learning curve. And I think we became more comfortable doing this kind of interviewing over the course of the podcast. How about you?
Yeah, I would co-sign what you said. You know, like the book, I think the podcast was bottom up. And what I mean by that is, as you say, we let the guests drive a lot of the content. Certainly we structured initial questions, but, you know, we saw that as, look, this is not the Aura and Peter show. This is a podcast about field research. And we are really honored to have these various guests take some time out of their very busy lives to talk to us and our listeners about their experiences, about the lessons that they learned. Certainly some of our thoughts and opinions opinions come through either maybe in an episode like this or the intro or along the way. But for the most part, as you say, we were really trying to center our guests, having them drive the content and the questions, again, like maybe a good semi-structured exploratory interview. I will say one of the challenges with that is that we obviously do have opinions on this stuff. And it was tough at times because I would say overall, the vast majority of the points that our guests brought up, I agreed with thought were really valuable. But there were certainly times where maybe I had a disagreement or I had a point of my own I wanted to add, but I had to again kind of remind myself like, no, the purpose of this podcast is to bring out these different viewpoints and opinions. And we're not trying to make it all be a nice, tidy little bow where everybody agrees and that all of these people are coming at it from the same perspective. So that was in many ways the purpose of the podcast. And I'm really proud and happy with us producing that product. But yeah, certainly it was different in some ways than being a co-panelist. It almost felt like we were the chairs of a panel some extent, but ones who didn't want to insert themselves, to use an academic analogy. So yeah, that was my experience.
Yeah, for sure. In this sense, there's also a similarity there to conducting research, although in a much less extreme fashion. I'm sure you've had this experience where you're interviewing someone for your research and they come out with something that you know is historically inaccurate or is in some way just kind of off. And you just have to kind of let them keep going because the job isn't an exchange of ideas. It's getting their ideas and their experiences. And we certainly didn't have any conversations in this podcast where I thought, okay, that's not accurate what they're saying, right? Our guests are all tremendously well-informed and very thoughtful people. But I think we both sort of had those moments where it's like, nope, we're here listening. And this is, we all do this slightly different ways. And it's really interesting to hear the different ways in which other people in our discipline approach the enterprise of field research.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, this kind of ecumenical or more pluralistic approach, I think comes through in a bunch of episodes, right? I mean, you could think about episode 8 with Robert Ross and Enza Han, where, you know, they're both scholars of China, but maybe they have slightly different approaches or thoughts on how to, you know, do research in China, or especially with the current challenges that are being put up today for doing research inside the country. Or you can go back to episode 3 with Erica Chenoweth and Zachariah Manpilli. And then, you know, that was one of the few times I kind of inserted myself a little and you as well to talk a little bit about research funding and, you know, how do you apply for research funding and what are the various challenges of, you know, getting government funding or not or whatever. I thought those were great conversations that were not designed to be, and I don't think were combative, but they certainly were enlightening in terms of saying, okay, here are some people who have done some great research, but not necessarily always with the same approaches. And I hope that our listeners can listen to that. And even if at the end of the day, they feel like, all right, well, I kind of agree with this person's approach or that person's approach. They learned a little bit more about alternative means. And then maybe also they find themselves somewhere in the middle or considering, you know, altering a little bit how they do their methods or how they look for resources. And so, yeah, that's what we're really, I think, trying to accomplish with this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that puts it really well. So to some extent, one way we can think about this podcast is as exploratory field research or some kind of like initial ethnographic study of political scientists as field researchers. So what do you think we have learned about our discipline and about how we do field research from the experience of doing this podcast and also from the book?
Yeah, well, I think one of the best ways to, you know, talk about that is to pull out some of these memorable sayings and concepts and pieces of advice that are from each of these products. I wanted to start with one. This concept of field being, which Wendy Perlman introduced both in her book chapter as well as in episode 2 on developing local knowledge, where she appeared both with Christina Greer and Paul Stanlin. So I just want to play a short clip from that and then let's discuss it. Your chapter in the book was titled On Field Being. Could you tell us a little bit about what field being is to you and how it differs from or complements fieldwork?
Yeah, I thought about field being as kind of a less instrumentalized way of going about developing a relationship with a world region or a location, or as we call it, a field. And it occurred to me when you guys invited me to write a chapter for the book that field work is so instrumentalized in a way that I almost found problematic, that we go to an area to extract data, to get information implicitly for our own purposes of producing work that we need for our studies, for our careers. And there was something that sort of rubbed me the wrong way about thinking about a field as work, as opposed to a community that you try to get to know, as opposed to a people that you try to appreciate, as opposed to a part of the world with which you try to develop a relationship. And when I thought about my own trajectory as a scholar of the Middle East, that I began my first trip to the Arab world was as a study abroad student. I went back as I continued studying Arabic. I returned to different parts of the region as a student. I interned at human rights organizations. I developed friends and had colleagues and had housemates and roommates and had a whole series of kinds of relationships that I built to this region before I ever even heard the word fieldwork, before I ever thought about fieldwork. And I feel really lucky that I was in many ways able to sort of build what for me has been a base of knowledge I've used throughout my scholarly career before I ever thought about having a scholarly career, and got to know a quote unquote field before I ever thought about doing something called field work. So I wrote this essay in a way to try to not promote that sort of a point of view or put it on the table that while we all face professional pressures and our students do as well, and there are so many limitations on what people can do as they are scholars trying to get to know a part of the world, that wherever possible to seize these opportunities for less instrumentalized ways of approaching the quote unquote field, and to encourage our students to do the same.
So I don't know if you can say it better than Wendy did. I would just say, yes, I agree with all of that. But thoughts on that, Aura?
I mean, I don't think anyone can say it better than Wendy did. That is one of the chapters in the book and episodes of the podcast that really, really resonated with me. So the experience that she's describing of having all of these different periods or stretches of time where she's living and working in the Middle East prior to even thinking about an academic career, that also really, you know, mirrors my own experience. I did something fairly similar. Rather than study abroad, for me, it was the Peace Corps. But I think having a deep relationship with the places that we study, maybe before we start studying them, certainly that's in practical ways makes it easier. It's easier if you already speak, you know, whatever language it is that you need for research. It's easier if you already know the local bus schedule and how to buy toothpaste. But it can also be helpful in figuring out what questions you want to ask. And it gives you like a sense of connection and commitment to the places that we study, which can be sustaining over the long haul. And it, for me at least, it, you know, it helps create a deeper understanding of why bother, of why all of this is important.
Yep. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't ignore the fact that there are some, you know, resource disparity issues here, right? Which is, you know, not everyone can, you know, just be able to go and travel and spend non-instrumental time in an area before they then do field research there.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, you know, there are more and more students studying abroad, et cetera. And, you know, this is something that I think is important to talk about because on the one hand, I'm not someone who trains or counsels or even would allow any of my students that I'm advising to go and do undergrads, to do field research with vulnerable populations or things of that nature. I just think that the amount of training and experience you need are far more than you can have as an undergraduate student. At the same time, I do think that there are students who are studying abroad who are looking for more than just a take a class and, you know, just, you know, party somewhere elsewhere outside of the country that you're in. And so I think that there are things you can do, whether it's, you know, working in local archives or just being cognizant of ways of observing the environment and the culture around you that can lead to maybe kind of more observational and less kind of participatory types of, if you want to call it field research or otherwise. I think that that's a really valuable thing. And I think that there's kind of a sweet spot there where you're kind of doing Wendy's field being, where it's not fully instrumentalized and you're just being a person, making friendships, experiencing a place, but then at the same time, maybe being conscientious and cognizant, if you want to, about learning about it in a way that you wouldn't if you weren't thinking a little bit about how to actually observe this stuff or ways to actually capture information about a place, which again is not location bound. I think that one of the biggest lessons I got from doing field research is that I became much more conscientious and just a better observer of my own community. You know, when I came home and thought about, like when I decide where to live, when I'm abroad, you know, doing field research in country X or country Y, or when I cold call people or kind of like, do I do those things in my own community to the same extent? I think some I did and some I maybe didn't, but I wanted to. And it gave me the confidence to do so and gave me maybe a better eye for understanding the politics and the society around me. So I think that there's some good lessons there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to, I don't know, a way in which field work or the mindset that we use for field work can continue maybe even when we come back. Another chapter that really spoke to me was Amelia Hoover Green's Fieldwork for the Fieldwork Hater. When we were first putting this book together and we'd written to this huge range of people to see if they might like to submit a chapter, Amelia wrote back to me and she said, "I think I might want to write a chapter about hating fieldwork. Is that okay?" And we both immediately thought, yes, that is more than okay. That would be terrific. That sounds like a really useful contribution to the conversation.
Unexpected, but glorious.
Exactly. And that chapter, I think, offers such a unique and useful perspective. She has this quote on page 118, where she's quoting something that she remembers writing in her journal, where she writes, "I am a mother effing grown up. I don't have to do things I hate," except she uses the grown up language rather than mother effing. This is a family podcast, so I'm going to use the gentler terminology. And that quote, I feel like, encapsulates this really important insight in this chapter, which is sometimes fieldwork is really hard, right? It is not this constantly joyful experience where you're having wonderful conversations and gaining new insights and having, enriching intellectual exchanges. Sometimes it's just really hard. Sometimes you're far away from home and maybe you get sick, or maybe just nobody's calling you back, or maybe there's mice in your kitchen, or whatever it is. And there's stuff that's just really hard to manage. And it's okay if it's hard, right? Not everything has to be a resounding success 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the fact that she acknowledges this so openly, I think, is really useful. And she also, reflects on the fact that if you hate fieldwork, you can do it anyway, but you need to be very careful that the fact that you hate fieldwork isn't having negative consequences for the people that you're doing research with, or even, for the quality of your research.
Agreed. Or, your personal and mental health as well. But I think sure. Those are great points. And I think you're right. I take away from that chapter a really important admission that, as you say, fieldwork is not always a joyous affair. And certainly you need to upfront recognize the challenges of being often far away from your own personal networks and friends and, et cetera. But as you say, her message throughout the chapter is not, "And this is terrible and no one should ever do this." It's, "Okay, there's a lot of challenges with this. I don't like many aspects of it, but I can find ways to do some of it because I see the value for my research or for learning more about these communities that I'm studying." And so, I think that's a really valuable one that resonates with everybody, no matter where you are on the spectrum about loving or hating field research. To add to that, another concept that we found really interesting in the book is something called the Onion Principle by David Layton. And it's a pretty simple one, but obviously reveals much more important and deep values behind it. And the Onion Principle, as Layton states it, is, quote, "Do not write about a country unless you can buy onions at the market price." So again, kind of a simple saying, but when you think about it, what does that mean to you, Aura?
I think in some ways, this gets at one of the larger points in Wendy's chapter, which is that there's real value in engaging in unstructured time where you're spending time in a country without an explicit purpose other than to spend time there and to just get to know the country a little bit. And, of course, there are ways that when you drill down into the onion principle, right, there are all kinds of different implications. Onions may cost more in one part of the country than in another, right? So there's also useful local expertise in, in particular cities. There are all kinds of ways that we can think about local knowledge and local expertise. It also makes me wonder, how many times have I gotten ripped off buying onions?
It's very possible. Yeah, I think you bring up some good points. And I think, one of the other things Layton would offer is simply, when you're getting ripped off, is that because, you're seen as a foreigner or an outsider, someone who really doesn't understand the local context? And so, I think this is just a further statement to really do good field research, to have people in a community trust you, to understand the context of what's going on, requires engagement and not just kind of flying in, flying out. Because similarly to buying onions is in some ways a metaphor for, buying what someone is telling you or why they're willing to talk to you. And if you don't know that local context, you're kind of flying blind there and maybe getting ripped off, or maybe no one's trying to rip you off, but they're just saying things that maybe you should take with a grain of salt or really try to understand what they're not saying because they're fearful or, whatever else it is. You can't understand that if you don't have local knowledge of an area and its people. And so I think that's an important takeaway. What are some other pieces of memorable advice that you find from the book or from the podcast?
Ian Lustig's chapter, which I think was one of the first that was sent to us. In fact, I think he might have sent his chapter in before anybody else did. And I think I read it twice in a row immediately and was just so so incredibly moved by it because he talks so openly about the emotional component of field research and encourages us not to hide from the emotions that field research may bring up, but rather to recognize our own human responses to what we're seeing and to what we're experiencing, and to engage with that, hopefully in ways that help us produce better and more human and more ethical and just the better research. So let's take a minute and play a clip from his interview with us.
Your chapter, which actually leads off our book, and the chapter is entitled Fieldwork and Emotions, you wrote the following, quote, "Learning, especially in the field, also takes emotional engagement and the ability to notice and track the character of that engagement. A researcher's emotions are sometimes rarely discussed in the systematic, quote unquote, objective realm of academia. Could you explain what you mean by emotional engagement and why it's so important in fieldwork?"
I'll start off by saying that I talk to my students in almost every class I teach about this when I tell them how to read, because I tell them that when they read, they cannot get what they need to from their cortex alone. They need to take a pen and react emotionally to what they're reading. It can be curiosity, anger, sympathy, outrage, horror, but they need to register that because as human beings, when we encounter the world, the cortex is only one way we integrate information and understand what's going on. In field work, the emotions are usually much more readily accessible than when you're sitting in a library or at your desk reading. So it's easier to feel their effects. But also, my point is that people should be aware and legitimize their interpretation of those emotions as sources of information. It's also the case, I mean, just think about it. When you may be able to remember an idea or two that your favorite professor in college said in a lecture, but probably not very much. However, you are going to remember how that person made you feel. And that's what I mean by the importance of emotional engagement. If you're going to register what's going on, integrate it into your cognitive map, remember it and have it be available later for analysis and cogitation.
So what I love about that clip is talking about this thing that we all, of course, have and experience all the time in our daily lives, and certainly when we do field research, but, you know, doesn't get written about as much, which is emotions. You know, so much of what we do is focused on thinking and analyzing, and as Lustig says, kind of, you know, your cognitive aspects of your brain, that this concept of emotions are something that we're supposed to keep separate. I think a lot of it goes back to this concept of being, you know, quote unquote, a neutral, quote unquote, objective observer or researcher. And, you know, again, I think that there's something to that. I mean, it's just kind of like you wouldn't have, you know, your parent or your sibling, you know, operate on you medically because there'd be too much emotion for them to maybe do a good job. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that when you're encountering emotions, whether doing your field research or otherwise, you should ignore those things, because not only does it help certain experience resonate with you, but it also impacts how you're perceiving them. And also, of course, the emotions of the people that you're encountering. And so I thought that was just an incredibly important clip, not only for how we teach our students, but also how we conduct our own field research to talk about this stuff more openly and to recognize how it impacts us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would also add that, you know, there's a couple of other chapters in the book that hit on this theme. Lia Balcells, in her chapter about talking about doing field research on a civil war close to home, in this case in Spain, where she's from, she talks about this and she says, "I recommend that future researchers prepare themselves to be versatile and open-minded. Every case and every fieldwork experience will be different and require a different set of skills. For me, doing fieldwork in Spain, a case that was emotionally very close, took a toll that I did not experience in Chile or Argentina, for example. At the same time, this proximity gave me several advantages: access to people through my social networks, knowledge of the local culture, and being particularly aware and sensitive of how different topics and questions could be addressed in the interviews. It also gave me training and insights that I have later used in other places and projects where I did not have the advantage of the, quote, proximity to home asset. Doing fieldwork close to home might be emotionally and politically complicated, but it also carries many advantages that facilitate the field investigation and contribute to the success of the research project. So again, I think talking about how emotions can be both a challenge and an asset, and understanding the intricate aspects of them, I think is just coming across not only in Lustig's, the clip that we played in his chapter, but the one from Liabal Sells and others. And I just think it's a really important topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely true. There's another quote or another bit of advice from the book that really resonated with me, and that's from the very last section of the book where we asked all of our contributors to send in short pieces of advice. And one piece of advice that I found particularly helpful was from Mark Lynch, who tells us to be careful about getting trapped in bubbles of like-minded contacts. That is, push yourself beyond just snowball sampling. Make sure you're not just interviewing lots of people from the same social networks. Part of the reason I like this quote so much is, now Mark may not remember this, but the first time we met was when I was a graduate student doing field research in Amman, and he happened to be in town for what, I don't know, but a mutual friend invited us both over for dinner, and Mark very kindly encouraged me to do exactly this. I was telling you about like who I'd interviewed and who I'd reached out to, and he encouraged me to just go ahead and cold call some people, which I was super scared of doing, like cold calling for the first time, particularly, like politicians, can be really nerve-wracking. And I really appreciated him, giving me some pointers on how to do it and, telling me not to be nervous and suggesting, some groups of people who might be helpful to talk to. So Mark, if you're listening to this, thanks. That was really great advice.
Well, maybe to continue the Mark Lynch Appreciation Society, as I think I mentioned before, he was my first political science professor as an undergrad, and I was not doing field research then, but I think you're right. He has great advice. And I think this is really important, right? Because it can be very difficult just at the outset to kind of quote unquote tap into a local community. And so when you first make initial contacts of people you get along with or you're interested in talking to or vice versa, it can be great. And obviously one of the last questions you often ask an interviewee is, hey, who else should I talk to? This whole concept of snowball sampling, which I think has a lot of benefits to it. But if there's a drawback, obviously those people are probably going to say others in their network, right? So you can very easily interview everybody or talk with everyone or interact with everyone in a certain network, but as you say, not branch and go into other parts of society. And I think that's a really important piece of advice.
Right.
It also dovetails with another one that I really liked. So, one of the concepts, I don't know if we explicitly explored in the podcast and in the book, but something I think a lot about, which is, kind of having big brothers and big sisters in your cohort. And I would say that one of the things I benefited from a lot in grad school was to have a couple great people, some of whom are on this podcast, Paul Stanley and Sarah Daly, who are a year or two ahead of me in grad school, who are doing really high quality field research. And, just as your advisors can give you these kind of grand plans and lessons and things from stuff that they've done, the people who are a year or two ahead of you know kind of, okay, here are the grants you can apply to. Okay, here's exactly what I've just been doing in terms of interviews, et cetera. And in Paul Stanlin's chapter, just talking about getting out of your hotel, don't only associate with expats, learn how to cold call, physically walk neighborhoods and, see what you learn from that. All of that really resonated with me. And again, they're kind of in some ways simple pieces of advice, but they're important ones because you can otherwise really get bound into, okay, I'm going to sit at my desk and type a lot, or I'm going to do XYZ, as opposed to forcing yourself to get out. And maybe in some ways, this is kind of like the Perlman, non-instrumental time that maybe in some ways ends up being instrumental, I guess, even if you don't think of it that way.
Or it ends up being really useful, even if it's not instrumental, and it can be useful in ways that are very hard to anticipate or even plan for. Which I think speaks to a final piece of advice that I certainly found resonated with me a lot, which is from Stathis Kalivas, who writes, "Be open to what the field has to teach you, particularly, and this is the hardest part, when it forces you to radically revise what you thought you knew about the question you were asking." Part of the reason why I like this passage so much is that I think it really gets at one of the core themes and core lessons of the book that's sort of a through line through a lot of the chapters and also throughout the podcast, which is be flexible. The whole point of fieldwork is to learn new things, to learn things that you didn't know, to be open to new questions, to new insights, and that going into the field thinking you know the answers and you just need to verify them means that you're going to miss a lot of really great stuff. Being open-minded, being open to new questions, to new ideas, that's kind of the whole point. And this is something that Dan Posner talks about in his chapter, Nadia Haj talks about this, and I think it's a really important insight about the nature of fieldwork.
It is. And it's a lesson that everyone will learn the hard way if you don't plan ahead or think about it. And you can't perfectly plan for flexibility. You can't plan, you know, the modular dissertation as Aidan Miliff talks about. But recognizing that that's going to happen and learning to be flexible and resilient, I agree, is a great skill for field research and probably for life in general.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So to kind of conclude this podcast, we're actually going to have some surprise interviews. And what I mean by that is we really believe strongly in doing a better job as a discipline, crediting those who assist in our scholarship. And this podcast is no exception. We want to help model this by taking a moment not only to name all of the individuals who helped produce and edit this podcast, but also to interview some of them. So first and foremost, I want to read the names of all of the research assistants who have worked on editing the audio for this podcast and working hard to put it together. So it is Zayad Anwar, Sam Biasi, Siobhan Farrell, Abby Hamilton, Alyssa Ifarenta, Hannah Jones, Garrett Madden, Madison Sarka, Gabriel Wallen, and Lila Zarella. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts to all of you for the hours you put in making sure that our interviews, our discussions, which, you know, were good, but maybe a little rough in parts, came out hopefully sounding great. All right, well, we are so excited now to go behind the curtain of this podcast and talk to the two producers. So John Gaiman and Harper Barbary are undergraduate research fellows at Boston College. So BC has this great program where you can have kind of research assistants from the undergraduate student body who are paid positions, and they not only learn a lot about the research process from helping with analyzing documents or editing publications, but in this case, I put them to work helping to produce this podcast. So they have actually led these teams of research assistants on editing and producing every one of these episodes. So we are so happy to have them with us. Welcome to John and Harper.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
All right. So our first question for each of you is, can you tell our listeners a bit about the editing process and how you take our audio content and turn it into a published episode? Let's start with John, because John, I know you were the kind of first producer in the fall and Harper has now been the producer for the spring. So John, start us out in telling our listeners a bit about the editing process.
Yes, of course. So on the research team, we would delegate the task into three separate divisions, being editing, mixing, and mastering. So during the first phase editing, we would splice, dice, and refine the flow of each speaker. And this is where the bulk of the work came from. Each research assistant would be assigned to a particular speaker's audio to edit, and they would become intimately familiar with that speaker's stories. And then during the second phase mixing, we would align all the different audio clips from the different speakers to ensure that the collective flow of the conversation remained consistent. And that aligner from that phase will become very familiar with each speaker's stories, as well as the theme of the entire episode. And finally, the last stage, mastering, is where we did a lot of the sound engineering and refining of the audio. And what we mean by mastering is that we want to have a strong grasp over the audio, so that way we had control of the volume, pitch, and intonation of each speaker, and making sure that all those are accessible and engaging as possible for the listener.
Fascinating. Now, remind me if I'm wrong, John, but did you actually take a class on podcasting? I know that that wasn't something around when I was an undergrad, but I think maybe you did that. Was that good prep for this?
Yes, I did. I did take a podcasting class. We didn't do a lot with the sound engineering, so that was something that I had to learn on my own. But in terms of scripting, setting everything up, and getting the materials that we needed for the podcast, that's where I learned it.
Excellent. So Harper, what would you add to that in terms of the editing process and what it was like on your end as being the producer?
Yeah. So first, I would say I definitely just learned a lot from John. So I'm really grateful to them for that. But I would say the other most important part of the whole process is just listening, 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 volume all the way up in your headphones, listening as closely as we could for any little errors or awkward pauses or background noise that we could do our best to fix. And I would say at this point, pretty much all of us on the team know both of your voices very, very well and can probably guess when you're about to laugh or pause or anything like that, probably better than our own voices.
Did you know that Aura was going to laugh right then?
I had a feeling, actually.
How about now? So in addition to being podcasting engineers and to doing all of the audio for this, of course, you're also both undergraduate students. So I'm also curious how working with and listening to these episodes, including the content of these episodes, did that have an effect on your perspective on political science as a discipline, just in general, and also how you think about field research in particular, right? Like you've listened to hours now of people talking about how the academic sausage gets made. I'm curious if that shaped how you think about all of this stuff. Harper, how about you?
So what was really great for me listening to all of these different guests and their perspectives was hearing that a lot of my reservations or concerns about the future of political science and field research are actually shared by all of those already like deeply involved in the field. So for example, I got to hear Professor Millie Lake emphasize the importance of knowing that the developing world is not your classroom as a new researcher. Or most recently, I got to hear Dr. Elio Zacchaio describe the complicated structural power imbalances of field research and the issues of who gets credit for what work. And for me, as an undergraduate in political science, it's really intimidating to even consider questioning practices of field research or the field as a whole. So getting to hear that there are established researchers and political scientists who are questioning and confronting these same issues that my peers and I are thinking about in our classes was really reassuring, actually.
It's great to hear that, because I think that's something that we were really hoping was going to come out of this podcast. So at least in some small way, it sounds like we were successful, even if just for one set of listeners. John, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I would definitely echo all those sentiments. It really showed that political science is fascinating, engaging, and driven from important experiences from our own professors that often get glossed over by theory and the midst of a busy semester. It really showed that political science is rooted in the lived experiences of those whom we're studying at a distance. It shows that we can bring the field to the classroom. And as we become more mindful of intercultural contact and intersectional identities, it shows how the field of field research will continue to evolve in various dimensions. And it also just kind of humanized the entire field, showing that even our professors who we really look up to have their own experiences and struggles with trial and error and just unexpected events during field research. So it really demystified the entire process of, quote, doing research. And it really brought to life in a different way what field research can be for any undergraduate who is interested in doing so.
I really like that phrase, bringing the field to the classroom. I think that reflects another goal that we had for this entire project, for the book, for the podcast. I really like that phrasing, and I'm glad that you felt that way about what we put together here.
Yeah, I think those are important points. This whole concept of like personalizing the professor, I know that you think about that as students and maybe how that's weird, but also helpful. But I'll say even as a professor, there's an element of that, right? Like I read so many of these people's great books and articles, but I don't necessarily know many of them personally or the experiences they went through to produce theses of research. And so getting to talk to them and to hear their words about it is incredibly enlightening. And again, it's kind of this like going behind the curtain process that we're trying with this project, both the book and the podcast. I know you mentioned this a little bit, Harper, but I want to come back to you. What were one or two of your favorite episodes or moments from the podcast that you produced? We'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. So one of my favorite moments was actually from the first episode we released on developing local knowledge. So it was with Professor Christina Greer, and she was talking about her research on Black and Caribbean identities in New York. And she kind of highlighted how important it is that researchers shed light on what she called shadow communities, or communities whose voices are never uplifted or researched. And she talked about how there were certain groups who have probably never been asked any questions about their lives or experiences or opinions, and how this translates into much more than just research. It translates into a lack of representation in everything, whether policy, healthcare, whatever. So it really made me question all of the research that I've examined throughout my studies and what I learned in my research methods class. And I think it was kind of a moment that all researchers should hear, like a reminder of how important it is that we question ourselves and question who we're questioning, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then other than that, one of my favorite moments was one that actually didn't make the cut into an episode.
Oh, no, you can't talk about stuff that doesn't exist. Nothing exists that's not published in the podcast.
In episode 10, Professor Driscoll had made a joke about needing to better publicize his book, and everyone on the episode was just cracking up, I think laughing for almost a minute straight. And during the middle of such thoughtful discussion, and also amidst the seriousness of everything that's going on in the world right now, it was so joyful for me to just hear that moment of laughter and kind of laugh with you. It was infectious. And it was so nice to realize and remember that even professors, and sometimes you think of you guys as stuffy academics, they're actually much more personable and are just regular people who have to laugh too.
I think those are great examples. And yeah, as academics, sometimes we are a bit stuffy, at least in the way of trying to kind of publicize or further our work. So yeah, I think that that was the source of the humor of Professor Driscoll kind of talking about, okay, you want me to like sell my book on this podcast? And yeah, how do exactly. I do that? And yeah, I think he was talking about how he wanted people to like click on some book about Trump that was a bestseller, but then actually buy his book, which I think would improve his like search preference in Amazon. But in any case, yeah, that's a great moment. Yeah. John, what about for you? An episode or two or a moment? moment or memorable from the podcast that you produced?
Yeah. So for me, there are two particular instances that stick out to me, and both of them actually come from the same podcast. It was creatively collecting information with John McCauley, Rich Nielsen, and Lindsay O'Rourke. And this was actually the first podcast that I ever worked on. So it was completely independent for the rest of the team. It was my first real engagement with podcasting outside of that one and only podcasting course that you mentioned. And I learned a lot of the ropes early on through this podcast. So it really became a sentimental experience for me. But in this episode, Professor O'Rourke spoke extensively about her experiences within the archives, even noting how some of the most bizarre and interesting things that you could find are in the archives. And one of those was a collection of doodles from the president. And she spoke about how some of the doodles portrayed the president as a representative of the U.S., having a forceful and authoritative control over a particular political crisis. I think it was during the Cold War and just global politics at large. And it really showed how some of the smallest things, even things that aren't reflected in our official documents or policy memos, can shed some light on the minds of our leaders and the status of the world. And it really showed that we hold our leaders to such a high expectation that we often forget that they're just like us, and they can and do sometimes drift off after a long day of meetings, social interactions, and unexpected twists and turns awaiting us at every moment.
Yeah, I think that was part of the episode where she was talking about doodles that President Eisenhower had done in the margins of some of his notes. That's in her chapter in the book, too. And it really is interesting set of insights that does exactly what you say, that like it humanizes somebody who we often think of as just being this historical figure, but who also was a surprisingly good artist, a thing I did not know about Eisenhower.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, we wanted to thank you both again for all of the work that you put in to making this podcast a success. It really would not have been possible without your expertise and your patience and all of your very careful listening. So thank you.
Yes, echoing that, you guys can produce our podcast anytime or hopefully run and script your own as well. You have incredible insider knowledge about this stuff now. And yeah, we're just so, so grateful for the hard work that you put in. I know that it's something that was a learning experience for you and an enriching thing, but it's also something that I know is a labor of love in the sense of contributing to something that we hope will be an insightful resource for graduate students, for undergraduate students, for young faculty. So just again, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much, Harper and John, for your help.
Of course. It was a pleasure to work on this.
Absolutely. It was a great opportunity.
All right. Well, Aura, it was an absolute pleasure and honor working with you on this project. Any final thoughts?
Well, likewise, I have enjoyed this enormously. It has been a real pleasure working with you as well. And to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed the podcast and that the insights from our guests made you laugh, maybe helped you learn something new, started some good conversations, and maybe got you thinking more deeply about what field research is and what it can be. I know that this has certainly gotten me looking forward to resuming my own field research whenever that becomes possible. Like a pandemic when we can't really travel, it was maybe a strange time to put together a podcast about field research, but it maybe was also the perfect time to put together a podcast about field research.
Agreed. Well, if you enjoyed this podcast, you know, please, please, please let us know. Write to us via email, tag us on Twitter, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or maybe most importantly, especially if you're an academic who's going to see us at conferences, just stop us and say hello. We'd love to hear your thoughts on your own field research. If you have any disagreements or things that this made you think about, we'd love to chat about it. This may be the end of the podcast series, but to us, it's really just the beginning of this really crucial conversation, which we are going to continue to pursue in a variety of contexts. So we wish you all the best on your future journeys, and we hope to see you out there.